Okay, so first, a note about homework two. Make sure that the benchmark programs are actually working. So that doesn't just mean whether or not the simulator runs correctly, but check their output. So for example, the Queen's program should produce this output when run it the way we suggested. Make sure you're actually running it to do that. Because if you aren't, yeah, the simulator will run it fine when it produces this output that you didn't supply command line arguments, but you're not going to get very interesting results for any of the other parts, but it will look like it works. The other part is that some people had trouble with that it looked like you were passing a file name and it didn't work. And there's this confusing thing, which I didn't make clear enough in the write-up, that the script we provide to you changes directory to the output directory before running the program. So if you pass a normal input path, it won't work. The easiest thing to do is probably pass the full path, which is why the description of the benchmark program tells you about the real path command. You could also potentially construct the relative path, but the absolute path that you get from the real path command is probably simplest. Please let me know if you have trouble with that. But it happens that the BFS program crashes if you provide the wrong file name, but the SHA-1 doesn't. It just doesn't produce the right output or do anything interesting. Which is why you should make sure that you're running the program you think you are. Another thing to check for is that if one of the programs is using a whole lot less instructions than the other, probably isn't doing what it's supposed to do. If it's only using like running for like 20 or 20,000 instructions or something, it's not what should be happening. And any other questions, concerns, comments on the homework? Before we get started? Okay. So, there we are. So today we had read some papers about cache coherency, which was about solving our little problem, that we have two caches with the same value, and we wanted to know when does the value actually change in the other cache and in memory? How do we keep those in sync? What is our choices? And both the papers we looked at today all talked about schemes in this big family of schemes where you just keep a little extra information for each cache block. And that information overlaps with things we've seen in caches before. So this information includes whether or not the block is valid. We already mentioned that in the Smith paper, that's part of the things you store in the cache. That happens to be also part of this, that it's merged together. Similarly, this includes whether the block is dirty or not. This is an extension of just having that old dirty bit. Now we have a little extra information to remember what we're doing with that block and what other caches might be doing with that block. And this state is stored in each cache along with the cache block. So in addition to a tag telling us what address a block stored in the cache is for, we have bits to store whatever the state are. And different caches are going to have different states, potentially. Not in all the schemes, but potentially. So it's not that this is the state for that piece of memory, it's the state in a particular cache for that piece of memory. The second paper we read goes through all the schemes in a lot of detail, and I'm gonna do a more unified presentation of all the schemes in that paper with different names for the states. And you'll see why I'm using different names, because it makes all the names sound the same. And I'll start with the simplest one, which is not the one in the Goodman paper, but something simpler than that. And I'm going to call this MSI for the names of the states, which are modified, shared, or invalid. And so invalid is straightforward. If a cache block is in the state invalid, you can't use its value. It isn't effectively in the cache anymore. The modified state is basically our dirty state. It means that we have a copy of the cache block, and it's different than the value in memory. And in this scheme, because we have no way of keeping other caches in sync, you're doing that sort of tracking, that we're just going to say that that means that we're the only one who has it. We're going to guarantee that we're the only one who has a modified block, if we have a modified block. And that means, in particular, that on every write, we have to get into this modified state. And anytime we leave this modified state, we're going to need to do something. And in particular, we're going to need to update memory. Because the policy is that if we're not in the modified state, the value in memory must be up to date, because no one's going to take care of fixing memory for us. And when we update memory, part of a side effect of that, when we enter the modified state, a side effect of that is going to be that we're going to make everyone else's notion of the block go away. They're going to forget about it. So every time we want to start storing a modified version of the block, we tell everyone about that write, and they hear about it, and they forget about their copy of the block. And so in these diagrams I'm going to be showing, the solid lines represent things that this cache does. So this cache does a write from the invalid state to enter the modified state. That's a solid line. Dashed lines, just like in the second paper, represent things that the cache hears about. So the cache hears about a write from someone else while it's in the modified state. It's going to get rid of its copy of the block and go to the invalid state. I also color these. So when they're colored in blue, that means to do this operation, we're going to have to send a message on the bus. So to read a value, we obviously need to send a message. And to write a value, we need to send a message even if we have it, just because we need to invalidate other caches. When we hear a write, and we have a modified value, we need to send a message because we need to get our modifications to memory first. And we hear about someone else wanting to write the value. They need to know what we did before they can use the value. Similarly, when we hear that someone wants to read the value we have it modified, we need to send that value back to memory before they can read it. So that's why that's blue, so because we have to do something in addition to transitioning from the modified state to the shared state. And that something is going to use the bus. And this bus is a shared resource. And we saw in the second paper that with their hypothetical bus, you could get maybe about, at most, 16 processors to usefully use it. There's a limit to how much the bus can do. So if we consider what the resolution to our original problem is for this protocol. So CPU1, again, is going to write to that shared value. So it's going to start in the shared state because it's not different from memory. And it's going to need to transition to the modified state. And to do that, it's going to send a message on the bus. Tell everyone, hey, I'm writing this value. You might want to know about that. It's sent on the bus, so everyone can hear it. But memory is not going to do anything with this. This is still a write-back policy, even though we send a message that memory can receive, because we aren't telling memory what the value is. So memory knows we're writing it, but it can't do anything useful about it. But our second cache, which has a copy, can use this message and say, oh, that means I need to invalidate my copy. And we actually have two choices. We could also write through and the same thing would happen. But ordinarily, memory won't be updated until later. And later, if we write a different value to this, we don't have to do anything. So in our original diagram, when we're in the modified state, reading or writing the value, that's a black edge, not a blue edge, because we don't have to send any messages on the bus. When we're in the modified state, we know that we're the only ones with a copy of the value besides memory. So we don't need to worry that someone else is going to be not going to be expecting to see a write and not have it. They're going to tell us by sending a message on the bus if they need our new value. So we can just do that locally. And this is where we get the big benefit that all these cache coherency protocols have, which is that usually when we're writing values multiple times or writing a value and reading it, we don't do anything with the bus and we save a lot of traffic over the most obvious schemes of write through. And this happens to be a very common pattern. And maybe later on, we'll be told, oh, I want to read this value. And we'll say, okay, I have that your value. I'm going to update it for you and go back to the shared state after writing the value back to memory. Okay. Any questions about this? So this is not quite the write once protocol, but this is almost the synapse protocol.
So that means that writes to memory happen in the order that you send them to memory? Is that an assumption that has to be true?
For this?
Yeah.
So writes to memory actually happen in the order you send them. That's the assumption we have. But I'm not sure where you think that comes out.
If it's in modified,
yeah,
and you write new values to it,
yeah.
If those values haven't been written to memory yet, but another, so won't the second cache then on a read?
Oh, okay. So, whoops. Okay, that was stupid. On a read, the second cache is going to tell us that it's going to say, what is the value? And we're going to have a way of responding before memory does.
Right, okay. So
that's the key attribute we need here, is that the cache which actually has the value needs a way of winning on the bus versus memory. And that's going to be part of the implementation of the bus, is making sure that happens.
So why isn't it sufficient that the read can't just be put in the queue of operations to memory?
So queue where?
As long as you have those two updates to memory before that read.
Yeah. So as long as the update to memory happens before the read completes, it's fine. The usual way of doing that will be to somehow let CPU 1 respond before memory does and suppress memory's responding. And there's multiple ways of actually implementing that, which is not a detail we'll go into. So one thing that I didn't talk about here was just normal cache replacement and write back. And that's basically unchanged. We just change our state to invalid, and just like if we change our state to invalid because someone invalidated us, we need to write the value to memory first. If we're modified, we don't need to do anything if we're in shared. But remember that cache replacement, as usual, still happens here. Just because we don't get a message from another processor doesn't mean we don't do it. But we just won't be concerned with it because that's not what these papers are about. These papers are about multiprocessing and how that policy works. So I gave you sort of the state machine description. And perhaps an easier way of thinking about it is to write down what the states mean. So the modified state means the value is different than in memory, and I'm the only one who has it. That has to be true with the modified state. And it happens if you look very carefully, and you could prove this, and if you were actually implementing a cache coherency protocol, you definitely want to prove it. But you can prove that that transition diagram I showed you will give these properties. So the shared state means whatever value I have, it's the same as memory. That's all it means. The name is called shared. We'll have a better motivation for using that name later. But It just means it's the same as memory, it's up to date. And the invalid state means you don't have it. So what were some of the problems with this really simple scheme that the more complicated ones we read about wanted to deal with? Why didn't we have some schemes with at least two more states in that paper? What problems were they trying to solve that we can't do with these states? Yeah?
Typically when one cache is modifying some block, it'll keep modifying that block over again. So it needs to have some knowledge of continuous being included.
So can't we do that with the modified state here? So your question assertion is that, you know, that we're gonna modify blocks lots of times.
Right.
But this scheme, that's fine. So if the value is different from memory, and if I change it to a different value, I don't need to tell anyone about that. And I know I don't, because I know I'm the only one who has it.
But then when it's modified and another cache does request it, poor ones will just write to memory and then read it. You actually want to just pass it off.
Okay, so your complaint here is that it's not that I can't modify the value repeatedly, it's that if someone else wants the value and I give it to them, the only way I have to do that in this scheme is to send it to memory. Because the only way anyone else can have a copy of the value is by getting it in the shared state. Which means the value has to be the same as memory. So that's a problem we're gonna need to add some states to fix. So there's one other problem that's a little more subtle that those other schemes in the paper had extra states for. In particular, they had another state for values which were the same as memory. So, does anyone remember what problem they might have been trying to solve with that? Well, let's go through a simple case of reading a value from memory and updating it. How many messages does this take? In the scheme, the answer is actually going to be 3. So first, we're going to read the value from memory. And that means we're going to go from invalid to shared. We're not going to invalidate anyone, we're just going to get whatever the current value is. From memory, causing someone else to write the value back to memory if necessary. Then, we want to modify that value to change it. The most common thing you do after reading memory, maybe. So we're going to write the value, which means we're going to go from modified to shared. And that has a blue edge here because we have to send a message on the bus. You have to tell everyone, hey, you might have a copy of this, I don't know. You need to get rid of it if you do because I'm changing it. And then eventually we're going to be done with the value and we're going to have to evict it from our cache or someone else is going to try to access it. And we're going to either go to invalid or shared and write the value back to memory. So that's a total of 3 messages we need to send to write a value where we use the value to figure out what to write, which is almost all the time we write a value. So what was the solution that some schemes had for this problem? What do they try to keep track of? Which of these messages do they want to avoid? Or merge, or?
The invalidating of a cache step?
Yeah. So how do they replace that?
Don't they just give the cache a copy of the most up-to-date value?
Mm-hmm.
And then say, well, it's got to continue onwards, they'll document it.
Yeah, so we have some way of having the cache do its read from memory and knowing it doesn't have to do this invalidation step. And so, in the naming convention we'll be using today, that gives us an exclusive state, which is the valid exclusive state in the Archibald table. Which means the value is the same as memory, but I'm the only one who has it. And if we know that, we don't need to tell anyone about it if we change the value. Because they're going to request it for memory, and we're going to hear about that, and we're going to be able to fix it then. Note that this doesn't change the shared state. The shared state still means the same thing. When we're in the shared state, we could be the only cache with a value. That's fine. Everything's still going to be valid. We might not actually share it with another cache. But, you know, when we're in the exclusive state, we just know we're the only one. When in the shared state, we're not sure. And the key distinguisher we need for this is that when we read the value initially, we need to know whether we got it from memory or whether another cache had it, which means that caches need to respond more often than they used to. Because when we read the value initially, we need to know that the cache checked whether it had it, even if it was in the shared state. When previously, it would not have to do anything. So we've made more work for all the caches, which are just passively storing values. But we've gotten rid of that extra invalidation method, because now we know right away, most of the time, if we're the only one with a copy of a value. So now we read from memory. Yeah, that requires using the bus. But then we're in the exclusive state, so we can read and write the value as much as we want. And as long as no one else wants it, we don't send any other messages. And this gets us back down, finally, to the number of messages we would be sending in a single processor to memory. Right? We're only sending it when we get the value from memory and put the value back. Whereas with the MSI scheme as before, we were sending more messages than we were in a single processor, even when the value was completely unshared. That was a big reason why people didn't like doing cache coherency early, because the simplest schemes mean that you're worse than a single processor, you know, even if you don't use any of the other processors. And yes, in particular, yeah, we always need to respond to reads, especially when we're in the exclusive state. So another thing that this brings up, something that's not mentioned in the paper, either of the papers, is that they just talk about reads and writes. But something you could imagine doing is having a special kind of read, which is often called a read for ownership, where you pretend to do a write, but you don't modify the value yet. And if you do that, you know, you move the value into the modified state or the exclusive state directly by invalidating other caches. And this is a good idea if you're going to write the value anyways. So you might proactively invalidate other caches because you know you'll have to do so anyways, but you can just do it earlier. This is something that real processors might do in some circumstances. But it works in the coherency protocol. It's just another kind of read, a read that just says, I want to read this value into my cache, and I don't want anyone else to have it. So, yeah.
So is that what, like, processors do to sort of what's a semaphore, or like some kind of flag on a menu location?
Yeah, so I was going to talk about this much later, but we can just get to that. So, but I think last time we mentioned compare and swap, that we check if a value is something and change it atomically. And the way you actually implement this is you just take that block which you're checking and you get it into the exclusive or the modified state. When it's in the exclusive or the modified state, you know no other processor is doing something with that value. So you know that if you see it, that you can set it without anyone stepping after here and do changing the value. They can't change it because they would need to send a message to you to even read the value. So you know after you do this comparison, if you don't respond before you change the value you have in your cache, that no one else changed in the middle. And this is how you can implement those atomic operations. So it's not that hard. You just need, for the atomic operation, you have a way of getting the value into this modified or exclusive state. So this read for ownership is exactly what you would do to implement compare and swap. Okay, so we had our other complaint about the MSI scheme, which was that we have to go to memory all the time. The only way, and this is true in the MSI scheme, to send values between caches was going to memory sometimes. So here, that's true for modifying a value. We can read unmodified values from other caches, but to modify a value, because our list of states says doesn't have a way of having someone else have the value and have it be modified, we can't modify the value and give it to someone else without going to memory. So we cannot go to memory when we're sharing a value read-only, but if we're sharing it read-write, the scheme still goes to memory. And that's another thing we wanted to fix. So we're going to add another state, which is going to be called the owned state. This is kind of a confusing word, but it is the terminology that is typically used. It's confusing because conceptually, in any of these, the modified or exclusive or the owned state, conceptually, there's an owner of that cache block, a single cache which owns it. So the owned state means the value is still different than memory. It's like the modified state. But I'm not the only one who has it. However, I'm responsible for that value. I need to make sure it eventually gets to memory. And to accommodate this, we're going to change the shared state so we can have values in the shared state that aren't the same as in memory. So shared state is going to mean that the value is the same as memory or the same as some cache which is in the owned state. And in order to make this work, we need it to be the case that this value that's different than memory, that's being kept by some cache, is going to be served to all the caches. So the cache which has the value in the owned state, not only must it update memory, but to keep the caches consistent, it's going to need to give its copy of the value to them instead of memory. So we're going to need to arrange, just like where with sending a value to write to memory in the case of reads, we're going to need to arrange that this cache gives its value to other caches on reads rather than memory. But this is going to let us, throughout this whole process, as long as we don't ever go to invalid on the invalid state, we can read and write values in our caches without ever writing them to memory. So as long as we don't have normal write replacement, we can have multiple caches share a value, and they won't write them to memory. So if you read a value, write it, and someone else reads it, you go to the owned state. You serve that value as long as you have it. If someone else writes the value, they're going to go to the modified state, and they can take over ownership of that value. And that when they've gone to the modified state, they've committed to making sure that value eventually gets to memory. So if you hear about someone else writing the value and you've given them your current value, you don't need to do any more work. They're already set. And you're already set as far as updating memory. You've transferred your responsibility to them. So this means that in this scheme, usually we won't update memory unless we actually run out of room in our caches. And this is really attractive when memory is slower, which it is. So any questions about this? So this is our sort of final version of the scheme. So. So why don't I run through an example? So let's say we're doing MOSI and we do this access pattern here. So first, to read a value that when we don't have it, we're starting the invalid state, and we're going to need to actually get it from memory, and we're going to read it into the exclusive state. So we proactively remember whether or not anyone else has it, if it's easy to figure it out, and it is if we have to ask memory. Then we can write the value for free and read it for free. We don't need to change anything. And eventually, someone else is going to ask us for a copy of the value. And if it's another cache, the CPU 01 is going to tell CPU 2 about the value directly rather than memory. And it's going to transition to the own state because it needs to remember that, oh, someone else has this. That I can't just write it right now without telling anyone. So even though it's in the own state, to write it, you still need to tell people. That's what the difference between owned and modified is going to be. And the CPU 2 sees, oh, I read this from another cache. It's shared. It's not exclusive. And later on, if CPU 2 wants to write the value again, it can send it to the other. If CPU 2 wants to write the value, it can, the arrow's in the wrong direction, can send the value back, send an invalidation message. Or it can send an updated copy of the value, either way. Probably an invalidation message, because that's cheaper. And this is considerably cheaper than our normal protocols, where we would need to have some invalidations and memory writes that we wouldn't otherwise, like the early versions. So you saved a whole bunch of messages. Yeah?
So in that last state, so instead of invalidating, it could update CPU 1. Would that change the ownership, or does that stay the same?
It should change the, if you do that, you're going to probably go into the own state. good question. So do you think it makes more sense to invalidate or to go into the own state? What are the pros and cons?
I mean, invalidate only requires, I would think, one message.
Yeah, so the biggest issue with invalidating values versus sending values, which is a big choice we have all the time, is that invalidating is presumably going to take less time. This obviously depends on what the bus actually looks like. But for example, in the Archibald paper, the bus was only so wide compared to the cache block, so you need less time to send just an address and say, please get rid of it, versus sending an address and its value. So there's a trade-off there. So if you don't think the other cache is going to want the value, you probably should try to invalidate. If you think the other cache is going to want the value, you should just send it proactively because it's going to send another message anyways and you'll be saving time.
And where's that decision made?
That is made by the chip designer. And typically it's static, I think. It doesn't have to be, but I think typically they make one choice, which is what we saw in all the protocols in the Archibald paper. All those protocols they mentioned made a single choice about whether or not you always you update on a write hit or not, for example. You update or you just invalidate.
CPUs and memory system are configured so that there's no race conditions.
Yeah, so a big subtlety that I'm not talking about here is what the heck, how the heck does the bus figure out who wins? And that's something which actually does need to work. That when two caches decide they want to write a value, someone needs to win. And the hardware needs to make that happen. And that we're not talking about the mechanism for that, but we need the hardware to make sure someone sends a message first. And we need something. We need the hardware to let the right thing happen in so-called transient states when you know you want to invalidate a value, for example, but you haven't finished sending the message on the bus to do so. We need to make sure that behaves correctly. And issues like that make actually implementing cache coherency protocols much trickier. Because you guys need to handle all those things about what order do things actually appear in the bus on, and who is going to win in the case of a conflict, and also what happens if I'm delayed in sending my message and I receive a conflicting message back. You have to handle all that. It's not particularly hard, but it's tricky to validate. And based on, so there's related issues, which are probably some of the most frequent processor errata, are things related, usually to synchronization, which is presumably related to these sorts of issues.
I saw that's related with the Intel apparently disabled a bunch of synchronization instructions.
Yeah, so that's something we'll talk about later. So we're going to talk about transactional memory, which is those synchronization instructions. Those are much more complicated than this. But they're a bit tricky to validate. So we have all these states here. And it turns out you can drop some of these states. So I give you three protocols, MSI, MESI, and MOSI. You can have MEI, not very useful, because you can't share values. You can have MOSI, and so on. So you can drop these in more configurable ways, and that's something you can do, and something we actually saw. So we can look at all the protocols in the Archibald paper as kind of a version of MOSI with some stage drop, plus some policy about when exactly you write or forward values. So that's my brief review of cache coherency. So are there any general comments on the papers? Yeah.
So in general, I was just curious, is it really that prohibitively expensive to change the network between the CPUs? So it seems like if you just added a second bus or a crossbar between all the CPUs, you would, this issue of bus contention would not be as big of a deal.
So the issue is not the networking cost. So the question is, why are we using buses? Aren't better networks easy? And the answer is, yes, they are. But that doesn't solve the cache coherency problem. You know, if I'm reading a value and I don't know where it is, I'm still going to have to talk to everyone. If I'm writing a value and I don't know where it is, I'm still going to have to talk to everyone. So even if we don't have an actual bus, we're still going to have the same communication pattern and the same overheads.
So even if you had like a crossbar.
A crossbar would be worse for this, yeah.
So could you not just go with a simpler coherency scheme that involves more passing messages? Is that a reasonable trade-off?
So it would seem like, you say a simpler coherency scheme. That's good question. It's going to turn out, for next time, we're going to read a paper on implementing a coherency scheme which is designed for non-bus networks. And the way that coherency scheme works is generally considered substantially more complicated. But it does avoid the issue here where you don't have it. And it's not the case that you don't have non-bus topology. So in a modern processor, typical topologies are not buses. So the most common topology, if you have a 4-socket Intel system, the the way the processors are actually put together, so this is, so socket is a physical thing you put a chip in. So these are multi-core chips. That's why I'm saying socket, not core. So socket 0, socket 1, socket 2, socket 3 is a fully connected topology. So better than a busbar, because you can send messages to everyone at the same time at full bandwidth. But that doesn't obviate the problems that you need to broadcast messages. If you want to read a value and you don't know whether someone else has it, you still need to send messages to everyone. If you want to write a value and you don't know who has it, you still need to send messages to everyone. And it's not clear what would actually be simpler, because any version where we take advantage and say, no, we only need to send a message to one place, is going to mean that we're going to need to remember where the value is. And that's the essential big thing that the paper that we're going to read for Wednesday is going to do. It's going to remember where the value is somehow. But that's a lot of extra work, especially because there's a question of whether the value changes places. So here, the information we need to keep track of is much less, so it actually is a simpler protocol. But yeah, it's a good question, because it seems like, yeah, this bus limitation is awfully bad and doesn't seem to let us scale to very high. So we had our scaling numbers from this is one of the graphs from the paper. So does anyone remember what this metric system power was? Can you give an inch a description of what that was about?
How much it filled the bandwidth of the bus, or something.
So, are higher numbers better, worse?
Higher is better.
Okay.
So it's like, how much the bus is being used, utilization.
So it reflects that. So, I believe the value was about the processor utilization you've got. So the idea was that 500 meant you were getting 5 processors worth of actual usable work, which is a pretty disturbing result here, since here we're accessing, we're accessing not that much stuff. It turns out that we don't get much more than 5 processors worth. We're accessing not much shared stuff. But we're not getting, because we have a bus, it seems like we aren't getting much actual throughput. So, did you think that was a fair way of measuring? Are there any caveats with that measure? So what they're basically doing is they're estimating how much time does the processor spend waiting on the bus. So has anything changed between when this paper was written in 1987 and now, which means that you have to measure this differently? SMT. So what about SMT changes it?
That means that you can hide those network latencies with another thread execution on the CPU.
Yeah, so we know that we can run multiple threads. And this is measuring, assuming that when we're waiting on something on the bus, that we can't do useful work, that processor is not doing work. But that's not really what's going to happen anymore. So one reason is SMT. The big benefit we got from SMT was when we could have a cache miss and then start running another thread for a while we were waiting for the cache. Or we were sending messages over this bus. And even without SMT, our out-of-order execution lets us do that. right, out of order execution, when we have a cache miss, we don't stop the processor. We keep going. We keep running whatever instructions we can. And we hope that the cache is fast enough, that the message we get back from the bus is fast enough that we get our value back. So how would you fix this evaluation to sort of account for this? Is it a little bit of work, a lot of work?
You could do some arithmetic about the average. So with that new information, that just changes how long on average you wait for work.
Okay.
If it's perfectly masked at zero, if not, it's something less than what it is.
So your proposal is that you just say that some constant percentage of the latency is hidden. So we just pretend it's less?
Yes, yeah, you're wrong with what you're saying.
So why do you, so any other sort of opinions on what a good strategy towards fixing this to account for our super scalar processors where we're gonna do something instead of just sending a message on the bus and waiting for a reply? Yeah.
So it could be like a best case analysis, assuming you can have n out of order instructions currently executed. So any latencies that can hold that many instructions are masked. So any latencies greater than that, you can just spark.
Okay.
You can assume that it always, you know, it's all
so we could do the optimistic thing. Okay. Other strategies you might try? What would be the best thing to do?
Should we simulate it with multiple systems?
Yeah, so the best thing to do would be to use something like what you're using for homework two, which simulates the whole processor and all those delays. So what do people think otherwise about the evaluation in the Archbold paper with graphs like this? Is anything missing? Let's go over what the evaluation was. So how did they choose their workload? Anyone remember, like, broadly, like, what class of application does their workload come from? So no one seems to remember, and probably the reason for that is that it's entirely synthetic. They felt that they didn't have any reference workload that was for the type of system they wanted. So they just chose some statistics for percentages of value accesses of certain types, assumed that they were otherwise random, and came up with an access pattern. Their simulator didn't even model addresses. It just used these percentages to decide whether it was a write hit or a read hit or a miss, write miss, read miss, etc. And did a little bit of work to make some values be more recently used than others. So that's kind of a little challenging for reading the results. So you have to trust that, you know, that sort of reflects our workload enough, our real workload. Was there anything, so they varied all these parameters. Were there any sort of notable, so the parameters that people complained about, they're not varying, so I know some people picked up on this, that aren't on this list. Anyone want to bring up what some of those are? I know some of you already looked at our reviews. What?
Block size, stuff like that.
Block size, so we are changing the cache parameters like we did in the other paper. Anything else we aren't changing? That might matter. So a lot of people complained about in their paper reviews, and was a good complaint, is that they chose basically a static bus configuration. But, you know, our decisions definitely are going to depend on what our bus looks like. know, it really matters how much faster it is to send an invalidate message versus a whole block. You know, and that's going to depend on how the bus works. How long does it take to start sending a message versus sending a longer message? And they didn't test that. They also didn't vary what the speed of memory was. So in this simulation, memory, I think, was 4 times faster than a cache to read from. It's probably more now. So that means that if you look at these results and say, how much better is one scheme than the other, this is going to understate the effect, which was mostly not very high, of the schemes which were very careful about sending values from cache to cache. Because they assumed a 1-to-4 ratio, and these days it's probably like 1-to-10, 1-to-100. Any other sort of things people have with the evaluation, either the inhibitors?
So would this picture change? One thing I was thinking, so the differences are so small with these simulated loads, I was curious how much you would expect these results to change if it was like actually running on like an operating system. Like, would the operating system overhead like mess around too much with the operation of these schemes?
So the biggest effect we're going to have from running this on a real system is context switches. So how do context switches mess this up? What do? They invalidate a whole bunch of things in the cache. Because we run something else, we lose our locality, which means a whole bunch of values are going to be kicked out of the cache by the new values we access wherever we switch to. Yeah.
Right, and the second paper didn't include any analysis of cold start, which is pretty much the same thing as no context switches.
Yeah, so we're ignoring. So they were ignoring what cold start, and that meant that they were assuming that we've been running this, that we're going to just run this program for a very long time. We're not going to worry about switching programs every 10 milliseconds, and what that mean, whether that means our first 3 milliseconds are much slower. We're going to assume that that's not a significant effect. And you could imagine that working different ways, because one question that gives up is like, what's the difference between the cost of the first read and write versus the other ones? Because we're going to have more of them. We have that cold start where someone else has been running and gotten rid of everything for our caches.
So another thing people brought up in their paper reviews is that a lot of people, and for good reason, really didn't like the first paper very much. They thought it was much harder to understand and more less focused than the second paper. So what are reasons why people might think that? Do anyone want to defend or criticize the Goodman paper?
Well, there were no figures, I suppose, that you could apply. All the reported numbers was that we said we saw this much better movement, but didn't show proper movement.
Okay. What did you think about the programs chosen in the Goodman paper? Yeah.
They seem like all pretty much standard, like single-threaded programs that really wouldn't need a lot of the cache coherency constructs.
Yeah. So all these papers, they have this problem that no one had a good multiprocessor that used shared memory at the time. And therefore, no one had written programs for their multiprocessors that use shared memory. So all their evaluation is with things which don't care about shared memory. So the Goodman paper was entirely this almost no share data case. Even though the whole reason you have cache coherency is to be able to share data safely. If we never share data, there's another scheme we could use, which is that we don't do any cache coherency and we just explicitly have the OS flush the cache on context switches. It's a thing that some systems might actually do.
It was cute how they evaluated the trace program that they used.
Yes. Yeah, it seems to be, that program seems to be floating around a lot of these old papers. Yeah, but they didn't have a real program that actually needed the cache coherency. So in the Goodman paper, it was entirely about, let's make sure our single-threaded programs don't run any slower. So they were avoiding, these two types of overheads. About avoiding these overheads, which make single-threaded programs that don't share any data slower, which is that, sometimes, in some of the schemes, we send invalidation signals that no one cares about. And that's going to take extra time on our bus. And sometimes, in some of the simpler schemes, you'd reload a value to from memory or from memory that no one needed to do. And they've avoided that. Now, any other comments, questions about the papers? Evaluation methodology? Okay, so we can talk about some little issues. So one thing we should talk about is false sharing. So all these schemes work on hash blocks. And something you might try to do is you might write programs which don't share anything but share hash blocks. So for example, here's some pseudocode for my multi-threaded program, where I'm going to sum up a numbers in parallel in a array. What I'm going to do is I'm going to get an index I and a start, and an index I, let's say, and I'm going to just iterate through an array from j equals I times n to I plus 1 times n. And I'm just going to set my own little sum for my thread plus equals sum array. So each thread has its own sum variable in an array, or an entry of an array, which is a sum, to hold its sum. And it's going to read different parts of the array. So these different parts of the array, they're very far apart, they're not going to interfere. But all these sums are going to be next to each other. So this might be our cache block, and we might have, this might be where sum thread is block 0, 1. We'll assume that it starts at the beginning of a cache block. And it might end up being stored such that, most likely will, different threads, elements of this array, are in the same cache block. So what's that going to mean with our cache coherency protocol?
Chatting
back and forth. What is that chatting going to look like? Yeah, so we're going to need to send the value for this cache block over and over again, even though we're only updating one entry of this array. Because the only way thing we know about the cache block is whether any part of the block is shared with another cache. We don't get to learn that they only need this little piece. And that means that whenever we change it, we need to, just in case, make sure that no other cache has a copy. And this means that if you write this sort of program and run it, you can do this if you know how to do threaded programming, or we can show you how to do threaded programming. And if you run this, you will find that this runs way slower than if you do something like, times 1,000.
to spread out the things into different cache blocks. And in fact, it will run often slower than the single-threaded version, because you're spending all that time waiting on the bus, where in the single-threaded version, yeah, you wouldn't be summing things in parallel, but at least you wouldn't be waiting on the bus all the time. So this is known as false sharing. And this is a big problem in multi-threaded programming. And the typical solution is don't do that. But the hardware, hardware is doing the right thing, it's just slow. And it's a huge performance effect. So for example, one thing the Linux kernel does to avoid this is that if you look at many data structures in the Linux kernel, they've carefully laid them out, keeping in mind of where cache blocks are. And they've made sure that things you might access concurrently are in different cache blocks. So that's full sharing. So it's an issue I like to bring up, and this is the right time to bring it up. And so it's something that you should be aware of when you're writing just concurrent code of any kind. So many people were curious, like, how close are these things we learned about to real cache coherency protocols? And it turns out that they are very close. So modern AMD processors actually use MoSI. That is the coherency scheme. So Intel uses something called MESID. So as you can guess from our pattern here, the M stands for modified, the E stands for exclusive, the S stands for shared, the I stands for invalid, and the F must stand for something else. And what that stands for is forwarding. So Intel has this, just like sort of exclusive is kind of a specialized version of the shared state. Intel has a second specialized version of the shared state, which is, the value is the same as memory, but I'm responsible for providing it, not anyone else. So just like with MoSI, we want to preserve this property that if the value is in another cache, we read it from a cache, because that's a lot faster. But we don't want everyone to think they have to do that, so Intel has a way of choosing one cache to do that, and that cache enters this forwarding state.
Why is it necessary to convey that value that you're forwarding is also the same as memory?
Otherwise, you're in the modified state in this scheme. The only way you're allowed to have a value different than memory is being in the modified state. And the reason is because we have, whenever you look at these schemes, it's not clear on this sort of diagram, but you need to have a way to know that memory will be updated if the value is different. So if our state doesn't know whether or not value is the same as memory, that means someone better be responsible, possibly us, for updating memory with the value. And since in this scheme, if we assume it's the same as memory, we're not going to know to do that. So that's why the assumption is there. Because if it wasn't there, there'd be some question. We couldn't guarantee correctness as far as memory eventually gets updated, assuming everyone discards the value, which better be true. So this forwarding state turns out not to be very useful in bus protocols. Why? In our old, why wouldn't we add this earlier? So why did those protocols in Archibald not have a forwarding state? What could you do instead? So could multiple people send the value in the model of the Archibald paper for multiple caches? Respond with the value they have?
System one is the bus, right?
Yeah, so whoever, in Archibald paper, there's a bus. Only one person can send messages from the bus at a time. So there's no way that multiple people would try to provide it and actually succeed.
So
So as long as you don't mind the overhead of waiting to hearing someone else and canceling what you were trying to do, there's no extra work. Maybe you could avoid that overhead, but it's not as big of a cost. The reason Intel is doing this is because of that topology I mentioned earlier, that we have this topology which isn't actually a bus. But we still implement a normal snooping protocol, where we, you know, when we want to look for a value, we tell everyone about it, because we don't know where it is. But these are point-to-point links. It's not a bus. It's not actually a bus. We're just simulating a bus. And that means that when we send this value here, you know, say, hey, I want to read a value. Do you have it? Which we need to send for correctness, because we can't just go right to memory, because we don't know whether someone has a modified copy. That if someone's in the forwarding state, they can just give us the value, and someone who's not doesn't have to give it to us, even though they're not going to learn whether or not anyone did. And that's the reason they have it. It's an optimization, so we don't have this case where, you know, we get two replies all the time. That we can just designate some people to reply, and hopefully have only one per cache line. So most of the time, we don't bother all of our other processors as much as we would. So in this forwarding state, do we need to do anything to go from the forwarding state to the invalid state? Do we need to send a message on the bus?
You'd have to update who's supposed to forward.
So one idea might be that, yeah, if I'm going from the forwarding state to the invalid state, I should make sure that someone is forwarding. So that seems like it's good for performance, definitely. Because you want someone to be forwarding, it's a lot faster. Is it absolutely necessary to do? So why not?
You just won't forward, and then they'll have to go to memory anyway.
Yeah, so it's fine, because the value is the same as memory. So that means that this forwarding state, just like the shared state, we can just get rid of the value if we need to. We don't need to tell anyone that we did it. So how about, so forwarding and shared, we can just drop right to invalid. How about exclusive? Can we do that? Can you tell anyone if we leave the exclusive state?
I don't think you have to tell anyone.
Why not?
Because you're the only one that have it.
Yeah.
I guess you're the only one that uses it.
Yeah, so we're the only one who has it. So they would have to go to memory. So we can drop it and they'll have to go to memory, but that's fine, because memory is up to date. So generally, you know, all this reading from caches is just an optimization. So for correctness, the only thing we really need to worry about is the value in memory going to be up to date? And as long as that's true, we can always just replace the value we have in our cache, which is good because we want to be able to put new things in our cache without needing to spend a whole lot of time sending things over the bus. And all the schemes we see most of the schemes we see don't do that as long as the value isn't dirty. Which is pretty much what we want. So as I mentioned a little earlier, so next time we'll talk about avoiding this broadcast. That, you know, even though we have a non-bus topology here, to make the protocol work, because we're not tracking who has what, you know, we need to still broadcast all the time. So it's not a bus, because we actually have point-to-point links, and sometimes we actually take advantage of that. We're sending the values back, we're sending them on point-to-point links. We're not tying up this processor's bandwidth with sending this value. but it's not great. In particular, we can see from the results in the Archibald paper that basically, with their assumptions, you couldn't scale beyond like 16 processors. Like pretty much, you might as well not have more. And that's the sort of situation we're in with these protocols. And the paper we'll read for next time, they wanted to have like 32 processors or more. 32 caches, I should say. And so they wanted something that would actually scale to that. So how does this interact with multi-core? So how many of you, when you, for homework one, did you have a system with a cache which was shared between multiple cores? Pretty sure it's more than the people who are raising their hand, but, okay. So if you have a multi-core processor, that's usually what happens. Not always, but usually. There is some cache that is shared between multiple cores. How does that work for these cache coherency protocols? Or how should that work? Does every core, so who, what are the participants?
Just the cores, right? It seems like you would just handle it like you would memory.
Mm-hmm. The shared cache?
Would be different. And then okay. The shared cache manages, I guess there wouldn't even be an issue.
Okay, so one idea is that you treat the shared cache like memory.
Yeah. You kind of look at it, and I think something that I was reading during homework one said this, but like if you have a 6 megabyte L3,
yeah.
You could just split it kind of into arbitrary sections and just treat it like it's separate caches for each.
So that would be one option, is that we could treat it like it's separate caches and have those caches speak the coherency protocol between them. This happens to be not very common. But it's a thing that is done. So the most common case is that the L3 is actually shared. So the simple thing, and the L3 is the L3 is the entity here. So these are actually usually L3 caches on modern processors that are communicating with each other. And locally, on each of these chips, there are multiple cores. Those cores keep in sync with the L3 cache, but the L3 cache is actually responsible for implementing this protocol. Now, to make that correct, we need some things to be true about the L2 and L1, which is namely that if something's in the L2, the L3 better know about it. Because if it doesn't, and someone says, hey, I'm modifying that value, and the L3 just says, oh, okay, oh, I don't have it, that's fine. We're gonna have a cache coherency problem. So the most common solution to this is to just ensure that the L3 has a copy of everything that's in any L2 cache. It's not the only solution. You could also have something where you check all the L2 caches. But the most common solution is to make the L3 be the only thing which does this, and just make sure the L2 always has, always contains only things that are also in the L3, and you need to arrange to communicate invalidations somehow. Eventually, like if you have a value in L1 cache and someone else writes to it, it needs to actually work. But the usual way of doing that is to have the last level cache be inclusive and be able to handle the invalidation itself, and as part of that, it needs to invalidate the lower level caches. Yeah.
So in a multi-socket system, would there be a sort of like a cache coherency protocol within each chip and also across the whole board?
Something like that. So I believe the one within each chip is usually dramatically simplified. But yeah, there needs to be some sort of cache coherency messages being sent within the chip. It's a bit easier when you know you have you could keep an index of who has what, for example. in an L3 cache if you want needed to. I'm not sure that's actually the strategy used. That's like an actual option, which is not really an option for memory. Yeah?
Is there an argument to not even worry about cache coherency? Like,
yes.
And if there is, what is it?
I mean, if you don't have sharing, you don't care. There's also an argument, and we'll see this. So one of the things we're going to talk about next Monday is going to be memory models, which is when do things actually get read and written? What order do reads and writes actually happen? And as a preview for that, we're going to see an example of that in our paper on Wednesday, where they're going to choose something where you aren't guaranteed to see all values being written right away. And that's a compromise they'll make. So there's arguments along the same lines, getting rid of cache coherency is a different thing, that maybe we should make it just more explicit rather than just doing it all the time. That maybe if we ask programmers, when do you need to share values, that they can do a better job than us. And for example, if programmers are telling us when they need to share values and what values they need to share, we won't have this problem. We don't have this false sharing, right? The programmer will say, hey, these four bytes, that's what I want to write, nothing else, rather than relying on this sort of implicit way, which is what we're doing. So there's an argument for that. Yeah. Typically, it comes from the idea that that the programmer can tell us what to do instead. Okay. So that's all I have for today, since it's 6:15. So paper for next time is the Dash multiprocessor, which implements a coherency scheme without buses and without broadcasting messages all the time.